You're listening to The Review, first broadcast on the 8th of June 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to The Review, your weekly preview and indeed review of the arts here on Monocle 24, coming to you from Studio One at Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, and Emma Nelson.
Coming up on today's programme, it went straight to TV in the US, but it's been wowing critics the world over. We get the full picture on Steven Soderbergh's Behind the Candelabra and other new releases.
Being somebody's boyfriend, this is not exactly the life that I had planned for myself, you know? I was going to be a veterinarian.
You want to help animals? Pick up the dog shit.
Matt Damon and Michael Douglas there. We'll also be hearing how the library music of the 60s and 70s has found a new following when we welcome back Quinton Scott from Strut Records for our music review.
Running away from life is hard to do, especially when there's nothing else for you.
And today we'll meet one of our neighbours, Atlas Gallery director Kathleen Fox Davis will be popping by to tell us about their latest exhibition of the works of Robert Capa, and she'll also be picking out some other standout shows from around the globe.
So lots to look forward to as ever this week on The Review here on Monocle 24. Hello, everybody. Hello, Emma.
Hello, Andrew. How's your cultural week been?
Quiet, actually, because I've mostly been here doing this. What has yours been like?
Well, recently back from a trip to Florence, I acted upon something that appeared on The Review a few months ago. So this is actually The Review having an effect. The critic Jasper Rees came in a couple of months ago and told us all to go to Florence and see an exhibition called Springtime of the Renaissance, which is sculpture and art in Florence, 1400 onwards. And I did. I actually booked a ticket especially to go and see it because of what Jasper said. And it was amazing. It is an astonishing exhibition that shows some art that is very rarely seen and has certainly never been seen together. And it explores why the Renaissance ended up being why it was, and the fact that everybody was reaching backwards to the Roman way of thinking and the Greek way of thinking. And it has some bits some exhibits in it which just explain why we have buildings the way we have buildings and why Italy flourished so well. It was quite an astonishing exhibition. And if you are ever in Florence, go and see it. It's in Florence until August this year, and then it moves to Paris, to the Louvre, until January next year.
An excellent thought. I'm jealous already. I like Florence.
It's not a bad place. It's suffering in some ways and doing well in others. It's now becoming the tourist trap for cruises, people coming
through.
That
was going to be my next question, is whether this exhibition has been organised with the thought that people might actually come to see it. I've been to Italian galleries where they seem vaguely surprised that crowds of people have wished to attend, with the result that you see a lot of the backs of other people's heads, but very little of the exhibits.
Florence is always going to be backs of people's heads. We went back to the Uffizi, which is that wonderful place, but is sadly full of far too many people, and they've got the numbers wrong again. You were queuing to get into some of the rooms, and as a result, you don't really look at the Botticelli. There was one marvellous moment where we were looking at the Birth of Venus, which, as many people know, is that wonderful image of this beautiful, beautiful woman arriving on a seashell on the shore, being blown onto the shores of what is clearly Italy. And in front of it stood the heftiest backside of a female tourist that I have ever seen in all my life. And my companions and I were just sitting there absolutely in fits of giggles as beauty with a rucksack parked her big fat bottom in front of us.
And were all these people taking pictures of it?
No, they weren't. You're not allowed to. But
no, that's something.
Because
that always kills me. People who take photos of famous artworks, presumably so they can show them to their friends and go, and that's what it looks like.
It made it really hot in there, though. And I did sort of go in there and think, goodness, what is this doing to the artwork? It's not great. Uffizi, you need to sort your act out.
You are listening to The Review on Monocle 24. And first to film. Michael Douglas might not seem the obvious actor to cast in the lead role of a biopic of an entertainer who could conceivably have been expelled from the Village People on the grounds of excessive campness. One might even wonder if Douglas himself still has misgivings about the role, given his recent attempts to persuade the world that he gave himself throat cancer by being just too damn heterosexual.
However, by absolutely every account, Douglas excels himself as the high-kitch entertainer Liberace in Steven Soderbergh's film Behind the Candelabra. It's just been released in the United Kingdom and will be popping up at cinemas all over the world throughout the rest of the year. It didn't, however, get a cinema release in the United States, where it also struggled for funding. According to Matt Damon, who plays Liberace's lover Scott Thorson, producers worried that it was just too gay. Observant bunch. I'm delighted to say critic and review regular Tim Robey has come back to talk us through this and other new releases. Welcome, Tim. You, in particular, wanted to focus on this film because you've been blown away by it.
It's such a joy, this film. Yeah, I think people were maybe worried when we heard that, you know, Steven Soderbergh, who's now taking a sabbatical from making movies, was going to do this final film on television. We were sort of like, why is it not good enough for the cinema? But the point is that he couldn't have got it made, really, any other way. All the Hollywood distributors basically said, this is just a bit much. We'd need to tone this down. HBO were the only people who said, nope, we'll go the full gate with
this. I'm struggling to imagine a meeting at which grown-ups sit around a table discussing a biopic of Liberace and say, can you turn down the gay?
Indeed, yeah. And it makes this point right up front, actually. One of the first scenes where Matt Damon goes in to see Liberace performing in one of his Vegas kind of show halls in his full regalia, and a kind of twin of him comes on who's his protege, and they both start playing the piano at the same time, and all the kind of grey-haired brigade are applauding, and Damon turns to his friend and says, I'm surprised they like something this gay, and his friend says, oh, they have no idea he's gay. And it's just great. It kind of sets up this whole world in which somehow he was getting away with being the most ridiculously flamboyant gay entertainer, and most of his fans just didn't know, and he sold them this nonsense about how he was sort of engaged to some lady friend from his youth.
He actually successfully sued newspapers who made insinuations of that sort.
He successfully sued the Daily Express, yeah, I think in the 80s for saying that, yeah.
I think the Daily Mirror just came out with an absolute catalogue of describing, I think they will use the word mincing, and that was it. He got £8,000 from the Daily Mirror and said he cried all the way to the bank, which would subsequently became a little bit of a catchphrase of his when he was challenged on his sexuality, wasn't he? Interviewers would say, people say you're gay, and you'll say, you say that about me and I will cry all the way to the bank.
Yeah.
Let's have a little bit of a listen of Michael Douglas.
Mind if I ask you something? How do you stay hard for so long? That was the fourth time since lunch.
You make me feel so young. And I've had implants.
Say anything right.
No, please don't be unhappy. I can't stand it when you have a face like that, especially after the money I've paid for it.
Oh, no, you want it back?
A little touch of Behind the Candelabra. It's astonishing, Tim Robey, the way that the music suddenly seems to complement the action.
Yes, that's right. Michael Douglas, who gives the absolute performance of his lifetime here. Okay, so it looks like he's totally reinvented himself, but in a way, he's perfect for the role. If you just flip the sexuality, he's well known as a Randy Casanova. He's rumoured to have been a sex addict in the early 90s, and he's playing this guy who pretty much is a sex addict. He's like the gay Hugh Hefner. He has this ridiculous mansion and all his kind of pert little companions tending to his every need. And it's just a brilliant stroke of casting genius to put Douglas in that role.
And you can kind of also, you can hear in those clips that Michael Douglas is absolutely having a whale of a time as well.
Totally. He's loving it. And he's just like treating it as a chance to kind of cut loose in a way that he hasn't for so long.
You mentioned the fact that they didn't want to make this film because it was just too gay. But we've seen films in the past, I'm thinking most in particular of the likes of Boogie Nights, which shocked because of their overt sexuality, because of the idea of pornography. Is it something that Hollywood is just having to get over?
I guess so. And with a film like this, big stars, quite a big budget, they were just a bit scared that the campness of it and the jokes and the cruelty and all of that was going to just come across and be off-putting to a kind of wide theatrical public.
But off-putting to who? It's not like there's no sort of vast, rich history of gay camp art being incredibly successful and being incredibly good.
That's true. It's just the inherent nervousness of every, you know, money decision in Hollywood. They're just like, oh, can we just tone it down a bit and then we'll get more of the Midwestern audience in. You know, this is the kind of thinking. Whereas on TV, HBO are well known for pushing boundaries in this respect, and they will actually kind of go the extra mile. They kind of, you know, the sexual frankness of some of their TV shows, like Oz, for instance, which has lots of gay sex in it and this kind of stuff.
This is the same Vegas-going audience, presumably, exactly the same people who idolized the real Liberace and made him the wealthiest entertainer in the United States.
That's right. What they don't want to hear is that he was actually this rather sad man who died of AIDS. That's the problem.
But who are the people that this is still news to?
Who knows? I mean, they're imagining this kind of section of the population who perhaps don't exist. But
you say Michael Douglas gives a performance of his life. So does Matt Damon in many ways.
I think he's tremendous in it, yeah. Really, really good in it. And in fact, he has the kind of lion's share of the screen time.
He has the tougher part, though.
He does. He has to start off at 17, and he nearly makes you believe it, actually. I mean, he just has that kind of fresh-faced thing still when he wants to. But the relationship that develops between them is really complicated and interesting. It's really sad. It's actually a kind of breakup story, really, ultimately. The whole sort of second half of the movie is one long breakup.
I mean, just listening to the trailer, it just seems indulgent, naughty, fun. Very, very, very funny. But then you say that the second half of the film is a breakup story. How does it achieve that balance? Because that's an incredibly hard trick to pull off.
It is, yeah. What you realise is that Scott Thorson, Matt Damon's character, who's this kind of trophy boyfriend, is in the same position that many other people had been over the years. And in fact, when he arrives at the mansion to take up his job, someone is literally being shown the door who had the same function before. And then by the end, you realize that it's just a kind of revolving door, essentially. But he is the most important relationship in Liberace's life, as I think he acknowledged. And then he kind of comes back at the end and they have a bit of a reconciliation when he was actually dying. It's very, very sad at the end. I was really surprised given how hilarious some of the dialogue is. I mean, there's one line where Scott Thorson is talking about how he's still young, really. And someone says, no, in gay years, you're like Judy during the Sid Luft obese period. And it's kind of like incredible New York gay kind of camp humour.
There is a delightful line from Soderbergh himself, actually, when he was casting the couple, which was, I needed to see Jason Bourne on top of Gordon Gekko. where do you think this fits with Soderbergh's other works? Because this just takes him in a completely different direction. But Soderbergh is a man who does like to go off on a complete tangent.
He's always reinventing himself. Yeah, he's done sort of almost every genre, I think, by now, and that's possibly why he's said he's going to kind of hang up the megaphone, you know. And I think he'll be back, because I think he's gone out on such a high here, and I actually liked his last couple of films as well. But this is an absolute peak, and I think it's going to be hard not to get him back.
Well, we should probably move on to another biopic you wanted to talk about. This is Ariel Vroman's The Iceman, the story of Richard Kuklinski, the mafia hitman.
This is all about Michael Shannon, who plays the lead character. So a brief history of Michael Shannon. He played the kind of creepy neighbor in Revolutionary Road and got an Oscar nomination for that. Last year, he was in Take Shelter, 2 years ago, actually, in Take Shelter, the kind of post-apocalyptic saga. And now he's taken this role, and he is so good. He's like the new Christopher Walken, I think. He has that kind of, as a sort of spectral intensity to him. He never seems to be kind of overdoing it. In fact, he's reining it in, so he hasn't yet gone for the sort of full Walken tics and mannerisms. But I just think he's fascinating, and fascinating to watch in this role. This guy who killed over 100 people before he was arrested and managed to conceal all of that from his wife and daughters. His wife is a sort of comeback role for Winona Ryder, who I think is a bit less good. But it's all about Shannon. I think the film is not really up to his level, in that it's basically hitman, killed lots of people, got arrested. That's sort of what you're getting. And it's done in this kind of sub-Scorsese sort of way. But, I mean, I think for fans of Michael Shannon, there are emerging fans, I think this is one to go and see.
Let's have a listen.
Might as well look out for each other, right?
You're doing hits behind my back. I can imagine what you've been telling them, thinking their dad's a decent guy.
I'm really proud of you, Richie.
Our paths cross again. I'm gonna bury your whole family.
Dad?
And that was Iceman, which is in cinemas now. It sounds rather flat when you listen to that. It just sounds like every single other thriller that's ever been made.
Unfortunately, it is a rather flat film. Despite there's a lot of kind of star cameos in it. James Franco pops up. David Schwimmer pops up with a ridiculous handlebar moustache. Chris Evans from the Fantastic Four movies and Captain America turns up as another killer who stashes everyone in his freezer. And you sort of think this is going to keep it going, but in fact the only real thing keeping it going is Michael Shannon's commitment to the role and kind of weirdly sympathetic. Even though he's sort of psychotic, we're weirdly on his side because everyone around him is so kind of whinging and needy.
Is there any kind of sympathy with the Kuklinski character? Is he just a nasty piece of work?
As I say, I kind of felt a strange allegiance to him, but mainly because the other characters were so whingy and flat. And in fact, they all want something out of him. And he's just getting so frustrated. And occasionally he'll kind of break out and, you know, just kill someone out of a sheer burst of anger. But you're actually weirdly on his side. That's what's sort of disturbing and so interesting about the film. Beyond him, though, it's not really what it could have been.
Okay, well, on the subject of whingy and flat, moving seamlessly along.
I think we're going to have a fight later.
Made of Stone, the new film of the Shane Meadows' new sort of homage to the Stone Roses, a Mancunian band who made one great record in about 1989, and unbelievably are still dining out on that. They're playing this weekend in London, in fact. How is it?
Well, it's Shane Meadows' kind of fanboy tribute to them. And if you're not a fan of the Stone Roses, it's going to struggle to win you over, I think. I mean, unless you're a big Shane Meadows fan, because his enthusiasm does actually shine through. I struggled a bit because I've never been, I don't actively dislike them, but I've never been quite on board. And I think there's a lot of stuff of them just sitting around saying, yeah, now we're back and now we've decided, we're going to do this gig. And I'm just sort of, I'm not that interested, to be honest with you. Not winning me over to that.
Does he use a great deal of Ian Brown's live vocals?
Oh, there's quite a lot of that, yeah.
Oh, dear.
Is that worth seeing just to see how off pitch he might well be?
Well, it's pretty bad. It deals with that sort of stuff. I mean,
what's his excuse then? Because Andrew Muller has his
excuse is he's tone deaf and he can't sing. Some people just can't. He can't. If you actually listen to any live footage of them, and I speak as somebody who is a veteran of their ghastly, disastrous comeback at the Reading Festival in 1996, but if you listen to him live, he just sings all over the note in the vague hope he'll hit one.
So inside this film, who is this for? Is this for Stone Roses fans? You said it's a Shane Meadows film, which is a Shane Meadows love letter to the Stone Roses.
That's right.
Is it about the Stone Roses or is it about love for the Stone Roses?
It is sort of about both, but I think you need to already love them. I kind of feel that because it didn't win me round. I could see it's actually quite a good bit of filmmaking, and I can see that Shane Meadows has poured himself into it, and it's not just a corporate kind of Rolling Stone style documentary sing along, you know.
Looking at it very briefly, because I think it was one more film that we want to talk about. Does it compare at all to 24 Hour Party People, which of course was a sort of a biopic of Anthony H. Wilson? There's a sort of a little niche being carved out of visiting Madchester. Do you think the Stone Roses film will sort of have the longevity of the 24 Hour Party People?
I think the problem is it lacks irony. And what 24 Hour Party People had was irony. And Shane Meadows has instead gone down the kind of enthusiasm route, which I think is fine and for the fans will be really enjoyable. It's just not for everyone.
Does he reach any solid conclusions about where that adoration of them comes from? Because it goes beyond people thinking, yeah, they made quite a good record in 1989. There is this this aura about them, this cult around them. Does he have any idea about where that comes from?
He does actually talk to a lot of people, a lot of fans, just at festivals and around, about what it exactly is. And they struggle to pin it down, to be honest with you. It's just this strange effect that they've had. They're a peculiar band to try and get sort of pinned down, I think. I'm not sure the film totally does, but I think it actually celebrates the kind of the mystery of them, if you like.
Tim, thank you very much indeed for joining us as ever. Tim Roby, the film reviewer.
You're listening to Monocle 24. After this short break, we will join Nelly Gotcheva on her weekly cultural roundup from around the globe.
Each week on The Curator, one of our Monocle editors rounds up the very best of the week just gone on Monocle 24.
I went to Afghanistan under the Taliban when I was 26 years old, and I sort of just saved my money and went to photograph women living under the Taliban. And now I realize, wow, that was pretty dangerous.
From hard-hitting political interviews to live music sessions, from food and film to retail and travel, we'll handpick the best of the week's shows for an hour of essential listening.
Affair at the end is on the one side a market platform, but I think especially here in Asia and in Southeast Asia, it should also be a place of an exchange, of a get-together.
That's The Curator, premiering every Saturday at 9 a.m. London time on Monocle 24, brought to you in association with Rolex.
Next weekend, come and join us for Monocle's very own take on an old English tradition. The second annual Monocle Country Fair will feature a selection of our favourite nations, retailers and delicacies. Wales, Colombia and Sweden will all be showcasing their wares and will have clothing from Drake's, Henchman and Trunk. And of course, the all-press cart will be serving piping hot coffee throughout the weekend. Plus, we've got a petting zoo for the little ones. So come down to Midori House on Dorset Street, Marylebone, London, next weekend for the second annual Monocle Country Fair. And that's fair with a Y, of course.
Of course it's fair with a Y, like there's another way to spell it. You're listening to The Review here on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller and Emma Nelson. And it's that time of week again where we take a trip around the world with Nelly Gotcheva to hear what's caught her eye in different cities.
In Paris this weekend, Space Culturel Louis Vuitton welcomes the exhibit Otherness, I is Someone Else. It includes works by Israeli artist Gil Yefman, drawings by Iranian Raza Hazare, and portraits by photographer Pierre Molinier. The exhibit is on until the 15th of September. Madrid welcomes the 16th edition of Foto España event, with the city museums and art galleries showcasing a cornucopia of international visual arts talent relating to images, videos and installations. Foto España is at various locations throughout Madrid until the 28th of July. For more information, go to phe.es. In Zurich, Luma Westbau welcomes the Pool Curation Programme and its exhibition Some a Little Sooner, Some a Little Later. The Pool Programme trains emerging curators to work with private collections on an international scale. For this exhibition, the co-founders have lent works from their own private collections, ranging from sculpture to photography, to be curated by South African independent curator Gabi Ngobo. Some a Little Sooner, Some a Little Later is on until the 18th of August. And if you happen to be in Toronto, stop by Field Trip Music and Arts Festival, curated by indie record label Arts and Crafts. The lineup includes Broken Social Scene and Feist, among others. And now let's hear Canadian singer Feist with her song My Moon, My Man. For Monocle, I'm Nelly Gotcheva.
My moon, my man, so changeable and such a lovable end to me. My cat, my coat, leave on a high note, there's nowhere to go but on. Heart on my sleeve, not where it should be, the songs out of key again.
That was My Moon, My Man by Feist, ending that report there by Nelly Gotcheva.
You're listening to The Review on Monocle 24. Incidental music, a strange, weird, peculiar beast, has to perfectly complement the piece of television or radio it's being used in, and it also has to remain more or less entirely in the background. Decades ago, the music libraries of the world's broadcasters were filled with shelf upon shelf of CDs and albums classified according to moods: classical, urban, gritty, pastoral, etc.
One of the great labels to supply the world with such music was KPM, and one man who's decided to bring the music out from the background is Quinton Scott from Strut Records. He's more known for disco and Afrobeat, but Strut has just released Music for Dance Floors, the KPM Music Library. Quinton is our music guest in the studio today. Welcome back to The Review. Quinton, I must confess, I have a soft spot for incidental music. A background in local radio meant that I used to, dare I say it, take home the CDs of these tracks of KPM. Explain to us a little bit more about what library music is.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting one. Library music has always been a bit of a sort of side room of the music industry, really. But it's, I mean, essentially KPM was a music publisher back in the early 1900s. And there's a guy at KPM, Robin Phillips, who really revolutionised the whole idea of music libraries. He decided in the late 60s to bring in rock and pop musicians, whereas before it had been quite a sort of a an orchestral thing. So it had been incidental music. It had been quite quite straight-laced, really, before that time.
It was astonishing. There was nothing that these music libraries couldn't offer you, no matter what mood you were seeking to put behind your piece of television or radio. There were thousands of these CDs. I mean, one got the impression that it was a bit of a factory.
It was. I mean, they were just ridiculously prolific. I think when, when he started in the 60s, they were doing, you know, sessions of recording sort of 20, 30 tracks a day. And they were just
not all of them that good, either.
No, I think they, they worked to briefs and, for different moods. And, you know, sometimes these things sort of communicated with the directors whoever were putting the ads, TV programs, films together. Sometimes they didn't. But, it's a very interesting area because I think, just with the sometimes these TV themes were not actually made as TV themes in the same area that they were picked up on, if you like. There was one track called Chicken Dance, which one of the composers, Alan Hawkshaw, was briefed to do an animal program. Did this track Chicken Dance, which then got picked up for a BBC TV program, Grange Hill. So completely different use. That was a sort of schoolroom drama for kids during the 80s, and that's the way it sometimes worked.
Given that this music was mostly cranked out by the yard, as you were suggesting, and given that its very job is to remain in the background, to accentuate the real action rather than draw attention to itself, how do you go about locating music that, or I guess what I'm asking is how much of that music does have a life of its own when it's removed from that context?
I think that's what we found doing this album was, the reason we did it is because a lot of DJs had found these albums. They weren't ever commercially available, so DJs had to really search to find them. And they would pick out these odd tracks from particular albums and use them in club sets. And also people would sample them. You get people like Jay-Z sampling them on his last album. So there were always these sort of little nuggets within the albums that were of interest to DJs and collectors. And also pushed up the value of particular albums. So, they were within the sea of music that's there. You know, they're just these very, very interesting pieces. They're always very, very tight and sort of 2-minute, 3-minute pieces, but amazingly well put together and, sometimes very dance floor friendly as well.
They always used to have the best names, if I remember rightly. They were the names that you would just laugh out loud when you heard. I think one of the things that you've got in your compilation is Assault Course and Samba Street and Reggae Train. I mean, it just has this astonishing charm to it, doesn't it? How did you find yourself falling in love with KPM?
I mean, it's very immediate music, isn't it? I mean, they're such good arrangers and composers that the riffs were just, you listen to them and they hit you straight away. There's no sort of 12-minute drum solos in there. There's just great riffs and melodies, and they're very, very talented people putting this together.
Let's have a look, let's have a listen, should I say, at to the first track that you've brought in to play for us. It's Alan Parker and Madeline Bell. Tell us a little bit more about it before we listen to it.
Yeah, this was one where people were taken from the rock world and brought into library. This is both Madeline Bell and Alan Parker were part of a 60s, really a session pop group called Blue Mink. And then they sort of did this little side work for KPM. And this is a track called That's What Friends Are For.
Running away from life is hard to do.
Alan Parker and Madeline Bell with the perfect Philly soul pastiche of That's What Friends Are For, the first choice of this week's musical guest, Quinton Scott from Strut Records. The next one you brought along to us, and I just wanted to announce this because I like the title of it, it's called Senior Thump, which is one of those satisfying phrases to say, isn't it? By Alan Hawkshaw of The Shadows.
Yes, well, yeah, he collaborated a bit with them, but he was also mainly in Emil Ford and the Checkmates. That was his big claim to fame. And then he called this track Senior Thump because his way of playing the Hammond organ was just very choppy and percussive. So, you know, they just made up names in the pub, really, for these tracks, you know.
One often gets that impression with KPM. Just listening to what we've heard there and going on to Alan Hawkshaw, these are absolute top-quality musicians, aren't they? Do you think that they ever intended that their music should be filed on a compilation somewhere in a dark library?
I think, yeah, I mean, they knew what they were getting into with library music. I think they just, Alan himself says, when he started off doing this, he didn't really know what he was doing. He went into a session on a brief and just did what he felt. And, you know, these guys were very naturally talented. This was very much in the early days of KPM, the early days of the 60s era, where, you know, it's just a bit more improvised and just a bit more groovy, really. You know, a lot of the sort of stuff gets a bit tighter sort of once you get into the 70s.
This is food on table, roof overhead kind of music. Let's listen to Alan Hawkshaw. Hawkshaw there and Senior Thump, one of the choices of Quinton Scott from Strat Records, who joins us in the studio to talk about KPM library music, no less. When we were listening to that, our producer Katie Bilboa was mentioning how evocative the music is. She had tucked in denim shirts, bell bottom. I had a little bit of corduroy, possibly a car chase, some cheap porn. What is in your mind when you hear this kind of music?
I think it's quite moddy, actually. That I think I can imagine it sort of. I can imagine a mod club with everyone sort of dancing away to that one. It's just that sort of.
It is very, very Booker T and the MGs, that one, isn't it? Mm. I was getting detectives with afros and big collars.
We have corrupt cops on car bonnets.
Yeah, that's what I was getting there.
Is that the secret of his success, though? Is that it is very, very particular in what it evokes.
Yeah, I mean, I think they were working to briefs for that. It was, you know, very much for each particular album was a particular mood. So I think they're always sort of trying to capture that with their music, certainly. But Alan Hawkshaw, you know, very, very interesting guy. I think that track, he then recorded it later on for another company, a track called The Champ, which went under the name The Mohawks, which is one of the most sampled records of all time. It was like a sort of Hammond groove based on Otis Redding's Tramp. And basically that's been sampled hundreds and hundreds of times.
It was that thing, though, that if you went to the KPM library, there was always something that sounded a little bit like something, a little bit more famous. But you knew that this is a way to get around copyright, wasn't it?
It was. I mean, it was very. I mean, the great thing about library music, it was easy to license and cheaper to use, basically for film directors and TV people. A lot of the times, they'd actually use library music as a temporary bit of music in a TV program or a film. And then they liked it so much they kept it. So that happened a lot, even according to Alan Hawkshaw. So.
It's probably an impossible question, but when you or anybody else is listening to this music divorced from its original context, do you think it is actually standing up on its own merits, or is it largely working for you through Pavlovian associations with, you know, where you might have heard it in the first place? Is, for example, Chicken Dance, which you mentioned earlier, is that still a good piece of music if you don't associate it with being the opening credits of Grange Hill?
That's a very good question. Yeah, and I think some of them are great bits of music in their own right, I think. I mean, they're just small masterpieces. Some of them are just, you know, work much better as TV themes. I'd agree with you. I think some of them are, you know, musically more simple and just work better as a simple theme.
How much did you have to listen to before you boil down to your compilation?
We did days, actually. Well, I mean, we loved it so much. We were sort of in there, you know, they gave us a lock-in.
Well, how often then? I mean, obviously we're celebrating the good stuff, but how much of it are you listening to? Sort of really getting the sense that people are sort of looking at their watches while playing their keyboards and their guitars, or do you get a sense of a sort of musician's will to live kind of ebbing through his fingers as he thinks this isn't what I wanted?
No, I think it's. I mean, generally you feel that their heart's in it. I think. I mean, I think you know, as Emma said, the quality is mixed sort of musically. Sometimes you're just not. You know, it's either a bit cheesy or, you know, the riffs are not that great. But, you know, there's just generally the standard of musicianship and arrangement is pretty incredible considering how prolific they were.
They were. I mean, one often got the impression, not as Andrew mentioned, but that they were just thinking, just let me do this, like the clock, you know, once the clock is up, then I'll get the check and move on to be purely creative. But the tracks that you're choosing clearly have such artistic merit. And let's move on to the last one, Keith Mansfield, Crash Course. Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, Keith Mansfield was another, you know, very important guy at KPM. He was one of their main composers, and he was in The Love Affair, if you remember that track, Everlasting Love. I think he was part of that, and then really had a career in library music and did a lot of big TV themes. He did Grandstand for the BBC, which is a big sports theme in the UK for a long time, Wimbledon theme, that kind of thing. This one, this Crash Course, is just a really intricate piece. I mean, it's amazingly played. It's on a slightly weird time scale, or time signature, rather. And it's just a great piece of music. And you could easily imagine it being picked up as a TV theme, but I don't think it ever was. So it's just one that got away.
Let's have a listen. We were all getting big 70s quiz shows from that. That was Crash Course and Keith Mansfield, the choice of Quentin Scott from Strut Records, our music guest here on Monocle 24. Quentin, where do you hear this music now?
I think it's, I mean, things have moved on quite a lot. I think since this was first sort of coming back as a thing for DJs, I think there was a whole jazz dance scene sort of back in the early 2000s, and it's moved on a bit. So I think it's more the sort of collectors and diggers who are sort of scouring the internet for these rare grooves who are sort of picking up on it now. It's a sort of slightly different generation and new listener that we find is picking up on these things.
And your CD, in the compilation is out now, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
Brilliant. Quentin Scott from Strut Records, thank you very much as ever for joining us again on The Review. And I think I can safely say this is the first time that we have had smiles all round at every single piece of music that was played. It's an absolute joy to hear these very odd little pieces of music. Thank you very much for joining us.
Our pleasure.
It's time now to spin the globe and hear what's coming up in one of our favourite cities. Last week, Andrew Tuck took the Globalist Asia on the road to the New City Summit in Sao Paulo. As ever, those programmes can be downloaded at monocle.com or on iTunes.
And he wasn't alone. David Michon was part of Andrew's entourage, and he sent us some cultural highlights from the city for the coming days.
Sao Paulo may not have Rio's reputation for leisure and fun, but Brazil's business city is brimming with culture. With some of the nation's best galleries, live music venues that range in specialty from rock to samba, and even a pretty decent stock of great architecture. If you find yourself here in Sao Paulo this weekend, here's what Monocle suggests. The annual BMW Jazz Festival kicked off on Thursday, taking place at venues across the city. The festival's top bill came in the form of 20-time Grammy-winning guitar virtuoso Pat Metheny. The But if you missed it, fear not. He'll be back on Sunday to close the festival with a free open-air concert at the Oscar Niemeyer-designed Auditorio Ibirapuera. But if you'd rather some quiet contemplation, Sao Paulo is home to some of the most intriguing homegrown art on the contemporary market. The city's small Galerias de Arte offer a beautiful selection of local and internationally recognized Brazilian artists. Gallery Red is a space designed by Paulo Mendes do Roca and features a mix of established work in the form of Rosângelo Reno and Cynthia Marcelle, along with developing artists such as João Loureiro and Rafael Assaf. On screen, Sao Paulo is playing host to the Cinefoot Football Film Festival until the 11th of June. The festival has been running since Thursday and boasts a roster of 33 documentaries, including 13 feature-length films. On Sunday, get tickets to see Ladies Turn, the story of a Senegalese women's football tournament playing at the Espaço Itaú do Cinema. The other of the festival's two venues is the Museu de Futebol, which is, in fact, one of the city's most renowned museums. But if you'd rather a cinematic experience that is a little less niche, you'd want to check out Faroeste Caboclo, a film based on a song composed by Renato Russo and released by Brazilian rock band Legião Urbana in 1987. The film tells the story of João do Santo Cristo, who leaves Salvador for Brasília in search for a better life and to help his cousin, but falls into a world of drug trafficking, which threatens his new love and his life. To hear you out, this is Faroeste Caboclo by Legião Urbana.
David Michon reporting there from Sao Paulo. You with the review here in Monocle 24. We'll be back after this to meet one of our creative neighbours.
Come with us from
Georgia
before we zip to
Istanbul
on Route 4 as we meet the people who are charting, finessing, celebrating and refreshing our metropolises.
You have to design a street for the speed at which a human being walks rather than for the automobile.
If you're trying to look at this place as an organ, it doesn't get enough blood. So it's on the verge of a heart attack, I'd say.
What's always attracted me about the square is that it is a London organism. It's something that's peculiar to this city.
The Urbanist is Monocle 24's show about the cities we live in that delivers insights into city halls, the views from the tops of towers, the stories of hidden rivers, and discovers why we still love that brutalist old beast, concrete.
Everything we use, touch, and our entire economy is based upon nature. The only difference now is that we tend to be less able to see that because we're living in a world of concrete, glass, and steel.
The Urbanist, presented by me, Andrew Tuck, premieres every Thursday at 1900 London time.
How far is the park? Does the park have a place where they can sit? Does the park have shade for them?
Join your fellow city lovers and leave the countryside to the people who prefer barns to bars and quiet walks to sidewalks.
Welcome back. It's Saturday, so you must be listening to The Review with me, Emma Nelson and Andrew Muller. Now, some may accuse us of being lazy. Others may just say that Midori House is in the right place. Because across the street from where we're broadcasting right now, the Atlas Gallery in Chilton Street in Marylebone is currently exhibiting a selection of the works of Robert Capa, the photographer who not only defined our ideas of combat photography, but our idea of the combat photographer, dashing, glamorous, somewhat vainglorious and doomed.
We're joined in the studio now by the Atlas Gallery's director, Kathleen Fox-Davies, who's here to talk us through their latest exhibition, as well as her other top picks from around the world. First of all, about the exhibition you're currently hosting, Robert Capa, what is it about his work that you think still seduces people? Is it the work itself in isolation, or is the myth of Robert Capa, which he assiduously cultivated himself, a part of that appeal?
It's definitely both. Robert Capa was and still is one of the greatest wartime photographers that has ever been. The reason he was is because he insisted on being on the front line in the middle of danger, which is unfortunately why he didn't live longer than he did. The images themselves stand apart as just completely incredible. When you saw the exhibition this morning, there are amazing works that are both personal, getting into the lives of the victims, the soldiers, the men in conflict, but also the bigger picture of just how grotesque and traumatic a lot of the situations and conflicts were.
Tell us a little bit more about the contents of the exhibition. Like you say, it's tiny. It's over two floors, but two tiny floors, and they knock you sideways.
They absolutely do. We have three conflicts covered within the exhibition, mainly because finding more material is quite difficult at this point. We have World War II, the Spanish Civil War, and the first Indochina conflict. With that, you see what's happening with the townspeople, the people in the cities, the Paris liberation, as well as the rebels and the official soldiers fighting, depending on what conflict you're looking at. There are almost 48 pictures within a very small amount of space. So there's a lot packed into the gallery over two floors.
Kappa's photographs were obviously taken principally as journalism, and there have obviously been any number of photographs taken of various conflicts since the development of photography, now more so than ever. Has exhibiting or holding or cultivating or curating this exhibition, has it given you an idea about where the point is at which what's done as journalism becomes art?
It's a really difficult line. I think with Robert Capa, it definitely is photojournalism. He is a photographer. He died on the front lines. He never lived long enough to see his artwork or his photography become artwork as we see it today as a collectible item.
It's fair to say, though, isn't it, that he wouldn't have been hostile to the idea?
Potentially not. He was a founding member of Magnum Photographs, which is now an agency that promotes photojournalist artists, as well as what we call fine artists. But his contemporaries, like Henri Cartier-Bresson, lived another 50 years, and was able to actually see his works not only from the photojournalism side, but also works become fine art. With Capa, they are definitely historical documents more than anything else, and I think that's still how we look at them today.
And as photojournalism moves into art, or becomes established as part of the art, we were talking a little bit earlier on before we came on air about whether these works of art are for sale or where they come from. I mean, who is collecting them now?
A very specialized group of people. It's something that's only taken off really in the past 20 years of seeing particularly Robert Capa, who's still very much undervalued as far as works for sale. But for our collection that we have on exhibition at Atlas Gallery, over half of them actually came from private collections. They're not for sale. They're simply for the public to be able to view pieces that are hidden behind closed doors most other times. It is a very interesting collector, though, that is looking into historical documents. So oftentimes they are collectors who also purchase first edition books or important objects in history outside of also their what we consider fine art collections.
Do you think what Capa used to do has become, and no pun intended, a dying art? I mean, we have seen this week in a sign of the times, again, no pun intended, the Chicago Sun-Times sacking its entire photography department and deciding it'll just train its journalists to take pictures on their iPhones.
It's I would say it possibly is a dying art. There is so much that goes into you don't see photographers putting themselves in danger on the front line. I mean, Capa was with the first group that came off the boats at Omaha Beach on D-Day. You wouldn't see a photographer necessarily do that anymore, particularly not if they're also using their iPhones instead of focusing on what the job at hand is, which was to capture the pictures and the moment.
Andrew and I were discussing this. Do you think, who is the Capa of now? Or is there one?
I don't necessarily think there is one. No one has been able to even touch what he's done since.
And your exhibition is on at the Atlas Gallery in Chiltern Street until the beginning of July, isn't it?
Yes.
We asked you, Kathleen, if you could bring in some places or tell us some more about some other places around the world, other galleries, which you think are really worth a visit at the moment. What's your choice?
There's a lot of interesting things. Obviously, my focus and interest is photography, so that is what I will be recommending. The first is Hong Kong. The University Museum of Art in Hong Kong is hosting hosting a René Bury exhibition. It's called Utopia, and it is focusing simply on architects and their architecture.
Tell us a little bit more about René Bury.
René Bury is one of the last living giants of the 20th century photography. He was a member of Magnum Photographs, was mentored by Henri Cartier-Bresson, and knew personally Robert Capa. So he holds a huge amount of history just in his own experiences. But he is probably most well known for his famous picture of Che Guevara with the cigar. That's what he's known to the public.
Which is probably the second most famous portrait of Che Guevara behind the Albert Corder was the
exactly.
other one, wasn't it?
Exactly. But this exhibition focuses on his images of architecture. I've worked with René Bury for many, many years, and some of the images I've never seen before. So it's a real opportunity, particularly in a city that has not necessarily always embraced photography as fine art or even had a real interest in it.
I was about to ask you, who now is the market in Hong Kong?
It's a very interesting, educated and engaged market. Photography is definitely growing there. It's really not even picked up the way it has in America and in Europe as considered fine art and being given the same importance in museums as well as art fairs and galleries. But there's a real opportunity there, and there's a real excitement about it because it is something quite new.
You also wanted to talk about Paolo Ventura's The Infinite City, which, am I right in saying it's coming to your gallery?
It is coming to our gallery in October.
Where is it now?
It is now in New York City at Hastrad Kraetler Gallery in Chelsea. It is a really special exhibition. Paolo Ventura is an Italian-based artist. He's never shown in London before until it will be in our gallery. This show is photography-based, but each work is unique, and he is constructing these fictional places with architecture that he's created and actually painting on Polaroids. So it's a really wonderful concept, beautiful objects, but a wonderful concept of the unique in photography, which obviously photography was invented for multiples.
You mentioned that he changes photography there. There's a funny argument around that revolves around altering photographs. What's your take on it?
Well, if you mean altering photographs as in Photoshop or altering it with hand,
either.
There is an art to Photoshop, and the people that are good at it are very, very good at it. I'm absolute rubbish, so I have a lot of respect.
But that's why you have a gallery,
exactly.
and that's why
I'm not the artist. But I do really love, and it's something I seek out when I'm looking at artists and gallery exhibitions that interest me. I love the idea of the unique in photography because it is obviously it's something that's not mainstream. So I love multimedia. What Paolo is specifically doing, it involves fashion, it involves drawing and watercolor and illustration, and then goes into photography, and it's a little bit of performance and also painting and drawing, and it's just this wonderful way of looking at a lot of different disciplines within the art and putting it all into photography at the end of the day.
And you wanted to talk to us about Isabella Brancolini.
The Brancolini Grimaldi exhibition, What is Contemporary? It's also, again, it's quite an interesting concept. The summer in London gives an opportunity for a lot of galleries to have a bit more fun with their exhibitions. This one is comparing contemporary photographers, Dan Holdsworth, Claire Strand, and Domingo Melulla, with antiquities, sculptures, Byzantine crypts, medieval objects, and it's a really I'm not sure
how does it work.
It's quite interesting, and there have been really mixed impressions to it because it is quite jarring to see these very stark, very contemporary photographs compared to something that you would never normally think to put together. And I think that it's a really nice way of changing the way we think about photography, which in itself has a very short history of 150 years, and comparing it to something that's about 1,000 years old.
Is this just a demonstration of the way that technology has informed art? Because what I'm trying to understand is how you do something like this without it just looking like a bunch of stuff in a room.
Exactly, which is...
I think that's what the curator does.
It's where the difficulty in curating does come. But it's actually taking ideas of form and line and these very, very basic techniques that students are taught first day at art school and that art historians are taught within their first year of studying how to look at a picture and putting it together. The way we view things has not changed. The way we are creating things has. And that, I've heard mixed reviews. Some love it, some hate it, but it's created a conversation that I think is very interesting within photography.
Going back to your exhibition at the Atlas, you were talking about juxtaposing and the way that you curate something. You have the Kappa on one side of the room, but on the other side you have ostensibly war photography, but from Russia.
Yes.
But that completely has an entirely different agenda behind it, doesn't it? So you're playing with the medium there, aren't you?
Absolutely. Just to fill in a little bit, we've got Robert Capa, and that's the main focus of the exhibition. But as a way of painting the entire picture, we also have Dmitry Baltamans, who was one of the official photographers for the Red Army from the Soviet Union, coming in from the Eastern Front. All of his photographs were centered around the wartime demands of the Soviet propaganda. So they were only published if it actually met the needs of what was needing to be said to the public.
And this is well worth seeing as well. Thank you very much indeed, Kathleen Fox-Davis. Thank you for joining us on The Review. If you're in London anytime soon, Death in the Making, Photographs of War by Robert Capa is on at the Atlas until the 6th of July. That brings us to the end of our Saturday review. For now, it's goodbye from us here at Midori House. Our thanks to our producer, Katie Bulbauer, and researchers, Fernanda Agosto-Pacheco and James Bullock, and to our studio manager, Claire Urban.
If you can't wait an entire week for your next dose of culture, the new edition of Culture with Robert Bound will be on air at 1900 hours London time on Monday. Here's what's in store.
On the latest edition, we celebrate 20 years of Barcelona's wonderful electro music festival Sonar, talk to the genius that is Rock's Robin Hitchcock, and head to space via leafy Greenwich.
Up next, Georgina Godwin will continue with the weekend edition, but from me, Emma Nelson.
And me, Andrew Muller.
It's goodbye.